All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code. A lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant. AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
I'm wearing this hat, Questlove, for you. This is my drumming hat in high school, in the high school band. So I know you play the drums, man. We play the drums, man. Yeah.
You still have that? Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right. I'm not nervous at all.
Good.
We got to get your hat like that, Amir. Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Questlove Supreme. I am Questlove, your host of the day. We are here with Fontigolo. Fontigolo, where you at right now?
I'm at the crib, man. I came in just straight from the gym. So, you know, so I'm sweating.
Same
here. Yep. Same.
Man, I want to know outside of 40, bro.
It's something about March that creeps in that says, okay,
summer coming.
Got to get my summer body.
Yeah.
Mine is picnic body. So.
Oh, yeah, 100%. 100%.
Yeah, I want to look halfway presentable at the picnic. Steve, how are you, pal?
I'm good. Really looking forward to this interview like everybody else.
How interesting was your evening?
Super interesting. Definitely trying to hear you pronounce words and so forth.
All right, Steve, as you guys know, I can't stop writing books. And I'm not trying to say I'm fortunate, but one of the things that I am not much of a fan of in the process of book writing is doing the audiobooks, especially when Steve is on standby to hear me struggle with college words. And he definitely got an earful last night. But look, we got more important pressing matters on our hands. Let me just say that I know that a lion's share of my personal music knowledge, you know, honestly came into play once hip-hop contextualized my parents' boring record collection, made it interesting, which, you know, basically by age 14, 15, 16, of course, I could rattle off any musician's name, but I wasn't a slouch either when I was a kid. But, you know, this knowledge I have of music really became a thing when I was a teenager. However, I will say that in my life, in real time, and I'm talking about when I'm 7 years old, there were two particular drummers who I idolized. And of course, if you're a longtime listener of the podcast, you already know that I've had the pleasure of doing a one-on-one with my idol, Steve Harone, formerly of the Average White Band. Today is no exception. And today we'll actually complete that circle, because if I'm really honest with myself, our guest today might be the first, air quote, fusion drummer that I became familiar with. Not exactly by choice. It just so happens that a particular family excursion of 1977 on a trip to Disney World in a van with an 8-track tape player as our entertainment, and maybe 6 8-track tapes in rotation. And one of those 6 8-track tapes had heavy rotation of the debut album of our guest on the show today, entitled Garden of Love Light. And one song in particular that I know that I personally put 10,000 Gladwellian hours in of practice was a tune called The Sun Is Dancing. And now that I think about it, I think the very first time that I nerded out on bassist, mega bassist Will Lee of the Letterman Show was more about him playing on that album than it was anything else that Willie has done. Willie has done legendary shit. But I will say that his resume is beyond impressive. Name it. Whitney, Aretha, Mariah, George Michael, Jeff Beck.
Devin Campbell.
Yeah, Devin Campbell, Barbara Streisand, Lionel Richie, Whitney Houston, Mariah Carey, Diana Ross, Rachel.
Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Chick Corea.
He's worked with everyone but me. And well, I think
time.
I think I'm trying to be him. You know what I mean? Not to mention, I will say that he's probably the first human being that I've ever taken note of that even mentioned the word that I'm obsessed with now, post-pandemic, which is meditation. So this is a long overdue conversation with the great legendary. Please welcome Narda Michael Walton, finally the Questlove Supreme.
Thank you so much, man. That's wonderful.
Been waiting on this for a long time, man.
Wow. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. This is wonderful. I'm a big fan of yours, brother. I'm a big fan of yours. You know, you bring the funk, man. You bring the soul and you bring the integrity to the music. So I'm really, really loving you, man.
I'm bringing everything I ever learned from you, man. So now, you know what it is? I'm also realizing I've met you briefly before, and I will say that there are very few human beings that have an instantaneous disarming chip that I wish I had. You have a level of calm that I now know that, of course, your resume is that impressive because I believe that you have a sort of calming element because you produced some people that I would believe would be some of the hardest people personality-wise to even step with. I've said no to a few of these people with just like drumming with them or any of those things because I couldn't bear to think of the thought of, you know, of dealing with that. But can I ask you, like, when did you develop this personality of just calmness? Like, you have a very disarming, like, have you ever gotten angry in your life?
Oh, yeah, sure. I do. Of course I do. It's just that I learned, like what you're speaking about in production and working with other people, that I wanted to get their best. And I realized that the love aspect was really powerful. It is really powerful. And then you mentioned meditation. So through meditation and the love aspect, that became the most important part. And that the person I'm working with could feel that love to do their best. And then that would just make everything just go. So I kind of just prayed. Swim, you know, get myself together physically, mm-hmm. and then get in that spirit that the person can really feel like, oh, you're not here to fight with me. You're here to make that great music. Then they start singing, do whatever they're going to do, and the endorphins kick in, and then we're gone. But that spirit of love is really, really important. That's what I want to say to you about that.
Do you have a pre-studio ritual that you do or something like to kind of get ready to get into that spirit?
You know, I don't know if you can see behind me, I have a candle, two candles here and a candle up there.
Okay.
You know, I burn a little incense every now and again. I usually bring a gift to the person I'm working with, just kind of make them feel the love on a physical level, a teddy bear, a flower, something sweet. And then I want to say one more thing about what you're asking about, because it's really important for me. That probably the most incredible moment along this line was after I made the songs of two songs, Who's Zooming Who, Until You Say You Love Me, and Here, and flew back to Detroit, Michigan to meet Aretha. It looking in her eyes is scary. Mm. That would scare you. That scared me. But there again, you know, I let her know in my spirit, my eyes, my love, I'm not here to fight. I'm not here to make a problem. I want to serve you, love you, and help us make the best music. And then once the music comes on and then she starts opening up and singing, then again, like I said, it just gets happy. And then it's like, well, what do you want to eat? You want cheeseburger, you want, you know, fried chicken, what you want, you know, and all that starts happening.
See, I wish I'd known you previously. Steve can attest to this. You know, of course, I'm still here at the Tonight Show. And
lovely.
And I've only had one client sort of put us through the ringer to the point where I just walked away.
Okay.
And, you know, unfortunately, I've had the pleasure of playing practically with every person I've ever idolized. But when it came to Aretha and the alpha level of testing that we were put through, I failed that test. And,
oh, no.
You know, it was like my ego was there because in my mind, I'm like, well, I'm holding up the tradition. Like, we are holding up the tradition of Cornell Dupree and Bernard Purdy, like her 70s, her 70s crack band. And, you know, she wanted to have a long talk and she wanted us to audition and all this stuff. And, you know, I just now regret that move. But I was just like, well, no, I'm fine. If you want to sing behind your karaoke track, then go ahead and do so. And she did so. And it could have been magic, but, you know, it was definitely, I didn't know about what you just said, like we're dealing with people and how to disarm them and all that stuff. And so, for starters, where were you born?
I'm from Kalamazoo, Michigan, between Chicago and Detroit, right in the middle of the country, Kalamazoo, where they make Gibson guitars, you know. And Battle Creek, Michigan is not far away, where they make Kellogg's cornflakes. And that's where Junior Walker All-Star comes from, you know, with all that funk. So I'm Kalamazoo, Michigan.
I'm only laughing because Kalamazoo is always my go-to random hypothetical city when I say something like, oh, you know, all the way in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Yeah. But I've never known one human being from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Well, now you do. Now you do.
I read a really interesting story about you in a magazine. I think it was Right On. I'm not certain. But the very first thing I ever read about you, I happened to be reading this story a year before we in Philadelphia. And I don't remember the exact lining of the earth, whatever, but I do know that we were about to go through in 1984, a major solar eclipse.
Oh, wow.
And it was one of them things where like the school was like handing out these sunglasses and you must never look in the sun or else you'll go blind and da-da-da-da-da.
Yes.
And I remember reading an interview of you where you said you were so inspired by Stevie Wonder that, could you tell that story, please?
Okay, brother. It's a true story. Okay, let me just go back up just for a second to say that Ray Charles, George Shearing, who are blind men, knocked me out with their genius. And then on the scene, my aunts, my mom's sisters, they're Vicky and Valerie, they're twins. They said, well, you know, on the scene now is a little boy your age, maybe a little older than you, but he plays drums better than you play, and he's incredible. I said, no. I don't want to buy it. And he said, oh, no, his little name is Little Stevie Wonder, you know, and he plays. I said, well, how can he, if he's blind, how can he even see the drums? Well, he does. Okay. But not long after came out a song that was a live version of Fingertips. And Fingertips was smoking. And I mean smoking like smoking. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to go to Chicago. My dad comes from Chicago. And go to the Regal Theater and see him play. And when they walked him out, it was like an alien. He walked like an alien. Slowly. Kind of back and forth. Like, you know, like I'd never seen him even walk like he walked. But now, in the audience, it's packed with screaming girls. Like Beatles. Screaming. You know? And when he gets the microphone, he's just in control. And his voice is high, like a little boy, but just every little note just so perfect. Just so perfect. And the band comes up, just rocking. And on the harmonica, perfect. And I just was like, it's true. He is better than me. He's got everyone in his palm of the hand. He's channeling God. And that was the summer of the eclipse you're talking about. So in Chicago, I decided, okay, if I'm blind, I can maybe be as good as these guys are my heroes. So I went and stared at the sun. I stared at the sun and make myself blind. But the good Lord said, no, you keep your sight. But I did try to make myself blind, yeah.
Wow. No, I read that story. And I guess we had, you know, the next cycle of that was sometime in 1984. And, you know, again, this, and also, you know, there's a thing like when you're a kid, an adult tells you no, you're just instantly like, even if it's to your own detriment. And there was one point where I was like, damn, Narada Michael's right. Like, if I'm blind like Stevie Wonder, I too can have gifts. And I was actually thinking, let me go outside and just stare.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host. NPR has a new collection of podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy and resilience, empowerment in creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Megan Thee Stallion to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Michelle Obama to the women behind the Montgomery bus boycott, there's no limit to the range of NPR. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and Black as the country they reflect. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
Do you remember your very first musical memory?
When I was really little, my dad bought a record home called Froggy Went A-Courtin' and He Did Lie. Froggy went a-courtin', he did lie. Da, 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 da. You know, I was a little kid. I remember that kind of thing. I also remember very, very young, I was so blessed by Santa with Toyland drum set for Christmas. That blew my mind. These little drums with the paper heads. So you play them, but the heads wouldn't last very long because it's made of paper. But I get orgasmic beating these damn things, and I see the happiness of my parents, my grandparents. And I got so happy. That's when I knew. That's it. That's a little kid. I guess just after that would be like then making pillows and getting a pie tin and playing along with Nina Simone live at Town Hall, you know, Summertime, and that album, the live album of hers, playing along with that. And then that became like kind of going on like that, you know, Ahmad Jamal and those type records, playing along with them. But yeah, it's just always there, that record, the young vibe, catching the spirit of the music. So important.
Pie tins were your symbols?
Yeah, a pie tin.
Yeah. We are the same person.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That is crazy.
Yeah, that's right.
So what is the significance of a pie tin symbol? What would we hear that on?
Well, you know, it just makes a high tin. Ting, tinky, tink. So, oh, okay. You know, it kind of, if you don't have a symbol, at least it can make a high kind of a sound like a cymbal. So, you know, and a pillow, like a flat pillow, can be like a bass drum or whatever you want it to be.
I would set up chairs.
Yeah, that's like, it.
I would set up chairs as my drum set, and then either the lampshade or a pie tin was always my. Damn, I thought I was the only person that thought about that.
No, no, man. I bet Stevie wanted to do it too.
That is crazy. Recently, I went back to my old neighborhood, and I saw there's a lady, you know, still living and down the block, and she was telling like people stories of, yeah, he used to always wail them drums. I used to hear him 5-6 houses away. So your parents lived in a household in which they encouraged you to make noise and all these things. And
I gotta say, my dad was like 18 when he had me. My mom was 19 when they had me. And my dad wanted to be a drummer, and he would carry his best friend's drums around, and a cat named Bill Dowdy from the Three Sounds. So he wasn't a drummer, but he loved it. So that was what? A big yes. You know Bill Dowdy from Three Sounds?
Yes. Yes.
Well, that was my dad's friend, and that's another record I was raised up playing along with. And my dad, quite frankly, the only time he really kind of gave me the kudos, like I could play, was when I could play note for note that record he bought. That was when he knew, oh, well, I guess you can play. But it wasn't until that.
Wow. So
I'm letting you know that the whole Bill Dowdy thing in our family was a big to do. And I could make noise. So you're right. The parents loving you, loving what the sound. It's important.
How old were you when you first started drumming?
A little kid, 5, 6, 7 years old. But I didn't take a snare drum lessons until like 10 years old. You know, rudiment, five stroke roll, paradiddles, you know, like that. And then, oh, your left hand is not as fast as your right hand. You got to work on your left hand, all that kind of behavior. But then I'm really blessed. Maybe around the age of 11, 12, there was a drummer on the north side of Kalamazoo, not far from my grandparents' house, named Harold Mason. And Harold was a black cat who knew independency. And he had a blue book of independency by Jim Chapin. So that book, you play a right hand written, ching, ching, ka-ching, ching, ka-ching, ching, ka-ching, like that. But then against it, on the left hand, the pattern keeps changing. So you have to kind of, you know, keep reading the changing and like learning your mind how to break it up. Then you bring your feet into it, your bass drum, your hi-hat. But then he'd be so advanced, he would say, well, you know, the jazz cats in New York now, you know what they're doing? They aren't just playing 2 and 4 in the hi-hat anymore. They're playing with a hi-hat, you know, whatever they want to do on the left foot. I thought that would be too much. I didn't want to get into all that. I was happy to play 2 and 4 on the hi-hat with my foot. But he was that advanced, breaking the mind up for independency, which really to this day helped me. A lot of people don't understand. It's like learning to ride a bike. Once you can do it, then you can play all kind of crazy stuff. So it happened early in my life that I got with Harold Mason. And then guess what happened? Harold went on to play the drums for Stevie Wonder. Now Stevie's a little bit older now, you know, Science Will Deliver. Those records are out. And they came through Kalamazoo, a place called Western Michigan University, the college. And the place is packed to see Stevie Wonder. He's a big star. So here's my teacher, Harold Mason, on drums. And the thing that caught the fire is this, and you'll appreciate because you're bad. Harold starts playing this groove and goes on the bell. Like 1, 2, 3, 4. Ding, ticky, ding, 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 ticky, ding, ding, ticky, ding, 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 ticky, ding, 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 like that. And Steve is catching fire with this. Stevie runs over, blinds up, pushes this cat off the drums, Harold. Gets on the drums and starts playing the same thing stronger. Ding, ticky, ding, 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 ding. I was like, damn. Then Stevie gets crazy. He stands up on the stool and the place goes, He falls off the stool on the floor, gets back up again, falls on the floor, and starts playing his groove. I'm like, these people are nuts. They're nuts. But it showed me the level of craziness you can go to. And it's okay.
You're one of the rare artists that, I mean, we've had a few artists on the show that have recollections of seeing one concert or two concerts or whatever, but am I to believe that even since childhood, you were just regularly seeing shows of musicians?
In Kalamazoo, Michigan, we're in the country, so it's not like I'm in the city. So no, I wouldn't say like I'm like in New York where you cats were, or Philadelphia. No, we're country cats. We're country mice. But our ears are big because we're hearing all the music out of Detroit. We're hearing all the music out of Chicago. You know, Five Stair Steps, Curtis Mayfield. We're hearing everything. We're hearing everything. We're hearing the brand new Motown, you know, Shop Around, Miracles. We're hearing all the new stuff. You know, Baby, I Need You Love. And before anyone even hears it, it's there at our parties. So that's what it was. It was just hearing the radio. And then I got to say, pop music, like Patti Page, Old Cape Cod, Johnny Mathis, Chances Are, all that music is just as huge in Michigan. So... Wow. You love Prince. That's why Prince is so badass. Because Prince not only got the funk, but he got all the white pop stuff just as strong. That's what it is. Back there, Minnesota, Michigan.
Right.
It's like a big old gumbo.
I see. Were you a big record collector as a kid?
Yeah, I love the records. I love the records. And I loved also like playing that song by The Who, I Can See for Miles and Miles and Miles in my basement. That caught my attention. I didn't even know who Keith Moon or anything that was. I just like the, I can see for miles and I can see, you know, that power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. who was your idol drumming wise? Do you play any other instruments besides drums?
I just play keyboard, piano to write my song, you know, having a keyboard to write.
So drumming's still your first love?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who were your idols? Like, once you develop your style, like, who's the person that I'm that person? Who's your North Star?
I learned from everybody. Harold taught me so much. Harold Mason, Stevie, that thing I just told you about. I was blown out by the charisma of Ringo Starr. I got to tell you, on the Ed Sullivan Show, to see him flirt with the chicks in the upper balcony as he was playing the open slushy hi-hats, but smiling at the chicks above, I thought that was badass. See, the charisma aspect got me more than the chops, just the swinging and the smiling. It's like, wow, man, okay. Then Mitch Mitchell with Hendrix was mean. Okay. Was mean, so I had to give him a lot of love.
All right, so I've talked to many an artist. And of a certain age, for a lot of them, their North Star was the Beatles on Sullivan. The same way, like 20 years later, of course, like Motown 25 was another North Star moment for people that watched the moonwalk. But I'm more fascinated when Black people speak of the Beatles on Sullivan. Like, could you explain what the fascination was? Because... was it just that there was nothing else? Like, what made Black people even open to that moment?
Well, okay. I knew the Beatles were coming because I saw their album cover in downtown Kalamazoo, and Paul McCartney had a cigarette on the cover. And that was unusual, just to see a cat having a cigarette bowled on the cover. Just small things like that. It was a Catholic school. And so the girls were already starting to rumble about the Beatles. It was already catching fire. And that was unusual because no one ever talked about music. So here they are, rumbling about the Beatles. I was like, really? You guys are into this? So when it hit, and the best thing was this, man, not just that show, but check this out. It'd be John Lennon saying, well, our favorite female vocalist is Mary Wells. I was like, damn, Mary Wells, that's Detroit. That's where I live. But little white girls and those at the school, they, who's Mary Wells? It's like, damn, that's Mary Wells. I don't know Mary Wells, they would say. Mm-hmm. And then John would say, well, also our favorite male singer is Little Richard. Little Richard, that was on a 78, you know, Long Tall Sally, all those records. So, but they had no idea who they were. So the Beatles really educated all these people who I knew, little white kids, whatever, to what was really going down. So I had to, and I liked that. That caught us, because they're now talking about Black people and giving a shine, which we never had. You know what I'm saying? That was a big to-do. And I'm telling you, man, this whole Beatlemania thing was real. So you're born, what, 71? What year are you born?
Yeah, right. 71.
Yeah. Okay. So this is like 63, 64. Mm-hmm. It was on fire. We never experienced anything like it. Just even the plane landing, looking at them coming out the plane, people going hysterical. So it just, you go, wow. The music was good, but it was all the frenzy around it. I mean, like, incredible. Damn. But then when they started loving Black people, I was like, I like these cats. Because ain't no one else talking about Little Richard. Ain't no one else talking about Mary Wells. So that's what it was, man. The catching of all these things that were like, cool.
Got it. All right. So how far is Detroit from Kalamazoo? And at any point, did you make a move to Detroit? Like, was Motown calling you or that sort of thing?
I would love to have gone to Motown. We would drive to Detroit to go visit a family friend or whatever and just go by the street. But, you know, you could never go in there. It was like, sacred territory. You know, you could never go in there. But just to go by it, just drive by it would be like a big deal. So I don't have any stories of like, you know, going inside there or anything. But okay. We all were just like, religion, the chord changes and the way they put it together with the sounds and the great singers. It was just a religion, man. Damn. Yeah. Yeah.
What was your band experience like in your teen years? Like, were you forming bands in high school or?
Yes. Yeah. My first band was, I was 11 and he'd be 10. He played Hammond B3.
Okay.
And his name is Joel Brooks. And he was brilliant. Like Jimmy Smith, a young kid, Jimmy Smith. So it was just drums, me and him on organ. And his uncle owned a little nightclub called the Ambassador Lounge on the north side of Kalamazoo, the black side of Kalamazoo. So we can go in the Ambassador Lounge and be the opening act because his uncle owned the place before Jim McGriff or whoever's coming through town was going to play.
What?
So it was, yes. So it was like firsthand experience playing, or where we were going to play before they came on. And, you know, that was just mind blowing because I must tell you also, a part of what I love is a record by a kid named Jimmy Smith called The Sermon is 22 minutes long. When what it did to my brain is E=mc². Art Blakey played a backbeat, 2 and 4, the whole record. Because, you know, most cats, jazz guys are busy. No. But do it just rocks like a blues record.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized the power of that. And that really helped me a lot. That you could just put it down and people love it even more. So man, those experiences when I was 11 with the Ambassadors, that helped me, that band. And then we bring a little horn player into it, or, you know, Captain who's studying at the university on trumpet, Pierre, or a sax player, or a vibes player, Carl, to gonna expand the sound. So I had great experience playing young like that. And then I would do the rock thing on my own bands. And then as I got a little older, I left home when I was about 16 years old.
Right.
And I'd go to keyboards. I play Fender bass, organ, and we do like What Does It Take by Junior Walker All Stars, those type of songs. But I'm playing mm-hmm. keyboards now. So, and then that band was called Distance in the Far. Then I had another band, I played bass. That's called the Mother Thump of the Flunkies. Now we're doing Expressway to Your Heart and Grand Funk Railroad, you know? Are You Ready? All that right. music. Yeah, so. And then before I left Kalamazoo, I joined a horn band, like kind of a Chicago horn band, but very progressive, called Avatar. And they were really, really like probably the most progressive band I've been with. And then my friend who played trumpet with that band, Bobby Knapp, he said, do you know about this record by Cold Blood? Called Sisyphus. I said, no. He played me this cat, man, named Sandy McGee on an album called Sisyphus. And to this day, you say North Star moment. That's still my North Star moment, Sandy McGee on drums.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So when's the moment in which you're like, okay, this is my profession. I am going to be a drummer.
Always. I didn't want to ever do anything else. I remember one day I had joined a band called Deacon Williams Soul Revival that came to Kalamazoo. They took me up after I didn't want to be in college anymore. I went 3 semesters of college. I packed my drums in their school bus and went out to play the Flint, Michigan, these little nasty joints. But it was so important that I did that because then I really knew how to connect with the people. And that was that same. And then I'd come back to Kalamazoo to go play some more clubs. And my dad would say, why don't you just become a policeman? You know, because this whole road thing for you. I don't know if you should be doing that. But no, I was always a drummer. Then that band decided to go out to California. Now here we are going out to California. I came out to California. You know, we played shows out here and, you know, in Hollywood and all that. Then that band broke up. Then I decided, no, I want to stay in California. And then that became hard. Now I'm a shipping receiving clerk downtown L.A., wrapping boxes, hearing music constantly. Just trying, how do I get out of here? You know, how do I save myself? And I had a few cousins, one that helped me out in Inglewood area, and another one out in Pasadena. He said, come stay with me. And I did. And then this there that I could like really shed. Because now the Mahavishnu Orchestra album just came out. I had enough money to buy that Intermountain Flame album. That just crushed me. I'd never heard anything like Cobham, Vishnu on that record. And 7, 9, 11, whatever. What the hell?
Talk
and
about
funky
it.
Like a fucking dog.
Yeah.
God. So that became my shedding. Shed. And then I also love Buddy Miles, the live album. Da 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 bam. Joe Tex. You know, then for spiritual moments, you put on Alice Coltrane's Universal Consciousness, side 2. You know, it could be Jack DeJohnette, you know, just like. So I kind of got off on mixing these worlds. the Calvin Cleanless, Buddy Funk, and the Jackie Jeanette Cymbals. I loved all that stuff. Then I met this cat, man. You might know him. Eddie Hazel. Maggot
Brain.
You
met Eddie Hazel.
Yeah.
I had a band with him called Ouch.
What?
Wait, what?
He was so mean because mean being good that he could play the funk really fast. That prepared me for Vishnu later. But he'd be like, and then you pass around this joint, but it'd be laced with PCP, the angel dust. So then you're really getting out there. But you know, you're looking at him because he's gorgeous, got his things on and gorgeous and just playing so clean, so fast. Aries. So those type of things happen for me, you know? I've had great experiences. Yeah.
I need to hear what Eddie Hazel was like from a person not in the P-Funk atmosphere.
Just a big brain. You know, like Hendrix, a big brain. You know, and not afraid of anything. The rock, the tone, the funk, the black, like early Prince, like what Prince could church. Like he was that. Could do anything like in those worlds and not scared of anything. And again, this powerful thing that would go around would be like, oh my God, I almost can't mess with that because I'm too sensitive. But it would just make you feel like, whoa, you know. So Eddie Hazel was an influence. I didn't stay with him very long, you know, because he was always moving. But he made a big influence on my life. You know, you hear Maggot Brains, that how he plays on that record. It's like, that's who he is.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Yeah!
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your high-five moment today? Only at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
I would like to know, at what point did the teachings of Sri Chinmoy enter your life? Like, was it during this period or was it later on?
Just after this period. This is my Pasadena, L.A. experience I'm talking about.
Right.
You know, and then I had to work hard to try to find work out in L.A., you know, very hard. And they even go back into being what's called a, you know, an orderly in hospitals to make ends meet. But it wasn't long after I got a phone call from Miami, a cat down there named Santa Tirana. Guitar player from Edgar Winter Band down there, Santa Tirana. He heard about me. He said, come down to Miami. So he bought my first plane ticket. I'd never been on a plane before.
What year was this?
It'd be maybe 71, 72, 71. Gotcha. Right there. See, because I graduated high school 70.
Gotcha.
So that's now the year you're born, 71, around that area, 71. Then I flew to Miami. And I liked Miami, and it really opened my eyes up again, because I wasn't at the university, but at the university, it would be all these great cats coming up. Pat Metheny, you know, Danny Gottlieb, Hiram Bullock, Cliff Carter, Patti Scalfo, who's now married to Bruce Springsteen. They're all these young people like that. But my friend was one of the teachers named Stan Samoli. And I stayed with him, and he'd have books on the guru. I said, oh, okay. I said, this is the cat who's inspiring my vision. He said, yes. So then you start reading the books of poetry on Sri Chinmoy that were inspiring Mahavishnu, the poems of Birds of Fire, you know, My Flute and Immortality, all these things he was writing that were just beautiful and very God-ordained. So I had a band down there called the New McGuire Sisters. Now, we really went full-fledged rock, fusion, out there, odd meters, to the limit, because now Mahavishnu Orchestra made it go there. Mm-hmm. And we had this big warehouse where the sound would just be like enormous. Like I could mic my bass drum with a big SVT amplifier. So I got used to just making this huge sound in there. And then not long after we got all this together, that band then moved to Connecticut, a place called Canaan, Connecticut, way up on the border of Massachusetts and Connecticut, a farm, mm-hmm. a barn where we could play, it was an awesome sound, and then a little cabins and a main house. And so we could kept working. But I was always scratching, how am I going to make it, brother? How am I going to make it? How am I going to make it? That was always on my soul. And then not long after came through Hartford, the Mahavishnu Orchestra's second album playing the Birds of Fire. And I had my friend, our manager, take me down to that show and drop me off at the show. And what this is really important, because you asked about guru.
Yes.
This is my first time laying eyes on the real living Mahavishnu and Cobham. And as I'm getting there, I'm a bit late, the place is packed. There's a bright light on Vishnu. And it's just him on double neck guitar and Cobham going at it. Maybe in 17, something so out there, you can't even count it. But they were like so intense with it. It was just nuts. So I decided to walk right down to the edge of the stage and look up in his eyes and see what the hell is going on. And I did. And I looked right up in his eyes, and he's just the bullets, just bullets. Just like an animal on fire. And his eyes are back in his head. And I go, God, this is real. It's too intense to be like memorized. It's just flowing through him. And it went on for so long. I could have been like 20 minutes of this. You know, I heard John Coltrane on record with Elvin Jones just be out there for the longest times. Mm-hmm. But I'd never seen anything live in a rock setting. Marshall's, Fives drum set, loud, clean.
Fives. Oh my God.
Clear Fives, loud, clean. It could stop like that. And back at it. Together. Oh, holy God. This is now my life. This has now got to be what I got to go to. Because if I do another direction in my life, I could die. I don't want to die like Jimmy, who are my heroes.
Right.
And I knew that Vishnu was into God. He'd found the meditation way. Because I knew about his guru. So that night, I saw a guy in white. I knew he was a disciple. His name was Apeksha. I said, please, Apeksha, I really have to meet Mahavishnu. Take me back to meet him. And he was so kind to me out of the whole audience. I'm nobody. He gets me backstage. And Mahavishnu pokes his head out and said, go in that little room and I'll meet you in 1 minute. And I wait in that little tiny room. And I'm scared because I've never seen anything like this. And I can hear Cobham and Jan Hammer, you know, high talk in the other room, like, McCoy Tyner, you know, and then Jamal Jones, and they're all. And then Mahavishnu comes in and he's like, English with this black Miles Davis talk. Hello, brother. How are you? You know, just it's like, what is that? But that's how he was. And I said, well, my name is Michael Walls. And I said, I've never seen anything like you. And I want to be like you. I play drums. And he said, well, you know, what I'm doing is largely due to my prayer life, my meditation life. I said, yeah, I know, because I read on the back of your jackets the poems by your guru. He said, yeah. He said, I'm going to see my guru at 6 in the morning. And I'll tell him I met you. Now, even that was like, bam, here mm-hmm. we are backstage in Hartford. It's almost 1 in the morning. He's going to drive all night, go back to Queens, New York, and see the guru at 6 a.m. That's not right. He's not going to sleep after just what I saw him do. Something so small like that just rocked my world. This is too much. And you know what happened? It's just God. Because about a week later, I'm way out in the country of Haney, Connecticut, in the woods at this farm I lived in. And the phone rings, and it's Mahavishnu. He says, "Hi, man, it's Mahavishnu. And I can't be there tonight, but I want you to go to the meditation in Norwalk and meet the guru tonight." I say, "Okay." Mm-hmm. So, man, I had long hair. I brushed my hair back, you know, and I got my shaver and I shaved my beard off because I know they didn't have no beards. And my mom had made me a kind of a white dashiki. I put that white dashiki on and we had an old limousine that the new McGuire sisters had. And my friend Greg Fell drove me down there into Norwalk. And when I got there, I was a little bit late too. So guess what happened? I go inside. And I lay my eyes on the guru. There he is singing, playing the harmonium and singing. He sees me and he keeps singing. And the girls are on one side and the boys are on the other side. They're all wearing white and the girls are all wearing these kind of Indian saris. So there's one chair left on the girls' side. So I sit down with the girls. And then this old lady named Akuti, she gets up front and she reads out of his new book called The Dance of Life Part 2. And the poems in this book were just like knives in my heart because, you know, it was just crying to God, you know, "Oh Lord, how many days, how many nights, how many minutes, seconds, hours must I cry to see your face? How long must I wait to see you?" It go on and on like that. And that hit me again. Maybe what you're asking for, Michael, I was Michael. Maybe what you're asking for, you're not really ready for. That's when it hit me again. Then I met a black gentleman just after this whole thing named Leilehan. He's all high. "Hey, hi. Let's go upstairs to the library. You know, buy a book and then I can take you to the restaurant called Love and Serve." Okay. So I go up to the library and all these books he had written. I have just enough money to buy a book called The Dance of Life Part 2 that downstairs they had read from. So I buy that one book and as I'm walking down the stairs, man, here is the guru in the living room, just standing there, kind of meditating. And so I stop. And he says, "So you are Mahavishnu's friend?" I said, "Yes." He said, you would like to become my disciple?" I said, "I think I'm ready." And he went into a long meditation, like just saw Mahavishnu, the eyes went back in his head. And just this feeling came over me as I stood before him. And then not long after, he said, "I accept you within my heart." And then he kind of walked away. But as he walked away, I kind of felt like an explosion happening inside of me. And maybe an explosion of gratitude that now I've met Mahavishnu. Now I'm meeting his guru. His guru has just accepted me. Who am I? That's what happened to me. And I was so grateful that to be accepted. And I knew that would save my life because I did not want to die. I'm the kind of cat, LSD, love the experience of being so high, but you can have a bad experience and be out of here. Or Eddie's PSPs and the angel dusts and those things. Can just get you out of here, man. So here, this is the God way. You just love God. You know, you pray, you meditate. You know, you do beautiful things and you offer your music to God. That changed the whole trajectory of my life.
All right, let me ask you something. Because it took me... No. I appreciate you sharing that. Because the thing is that it might have taken me about 5 decades to even be open to that level of spirituality, because, you know, for a lot of African Americans in America, like, we clutch onto our Christianity like no one's business. And any other kind of straying from, you know, what your grandmom taught you, what her grandmother taught her, what, and so on and so forth, back to our presence in this country, is often frowned upon amongst other black people. Like, I remember seeing an interview with like Maurice White of Earth, Wind & Fire, maybe in like in the late 70s, early 80s, where he's talking about this level of spirituality.
Yes.
And kind of looking at the adults in the room as he's saying this on television, they're frowning like, "Mm-mm, see, that's that double shit. He ain't talking about Christianity, da-da-da." So, like, what made you, because this is not, even though this level of spirituality is our African origins.
Yes.
What made you just sort of bypass the fear of what will others think about me, or what will my parents say, or what will my fellow Michigans people or fellow Black people, they think like I'm this weird. What made you just bypass that?
I wanted to save my life. It was just me against the world. It's just me against the world. How am I going to make it? This is the way to make it, Narada. Mahavishnu's accepted you as a friend. He's calling you on the phone. This is his guru. His guru's accepted you. It felt good to me. It was a way of living a good life, of having a way of directing my attention, my focus. And I needed that. I knew I needed it. I was raised Catholic. I was raised with Mother Mary, Jesus, all that, and Holy Communion and all that. I know all those things. You know, the Agnus Dei and the sanctuary and all the beautiful music. But that wasn't saving me. And I had been clobbered by Mahavishnu live. Not only on record, you know, unspoken heights, live.
I see.
And then to meet this teacher, he was beautiful. There was nothing wrong. It was like, okay, would you follow Jesus? Yeah. Well, there's a living example of someone living truth, talking truth. What you gonna do? So for me, it was a blessing. Absolute blessing. There was no doubt about that at all. Only doubt was, am I good enough? Am I ready enough? Like I told you.
When did he grant you with the name Narada?
Well, that came later. He told me later. So I'm not gonna spoil you. I've spoiled so many giving them names too fast or too early. I'm not gonna spoil you. I'm gonna make you wait. And it wasn't until the release of Garden of Love Light that he gave me my name Narada. And he said, Da, na, ra. That went on for so long. I don't know if my name was na, ra, or da. So he said, Narada. So Narada's the supreme musician. Narada's soul brings from heaven to earth light, delight, and compassion, and takes back to heaven from earth, earth sufferings. So through music, this is my role now as Narada Michael Walden. And yeah.
What leads to your deal at Atlantic Records? And on top of that, how did you link with, of all people, Tom Dowd on your first album?
I went through, after I joined Mahavishnu Orchestra and did like 2.5 years with Mahavishnu Orchestra, when that band stopped and Vishnu then went to Shakti with, you know, Zakir Hussain and that genius stuff, then I was really in a funk and a depression because now I didn't know what to do with my life. I mean, I'm high now. Now my chops, everything is, but what are you going to do? You're not in the band anymore. It's like the Beatles broke up. So I just tried to think of what I was going to do. I became a teacher for a while at the drum workshop, the teacher's thing, whatever it was called, someplace I played, taught down there for a while. Anyway, I'm saying to you, I just had to focus. And I thought, well, let's just go on to my solo career. So then my attorney was Barry Platt. He said, you know what? Epic Records will pay for you to make a demo. You know, because at least you got some name from coming from Mahavishnu Orchestra. I said, okay. So then I heard off Lenny White's album, Phoenician Summers, this cat named Raymond Gomez, who I thought, damn, this guy has got the chops like I'm wanting to hear. And then when I met him, he had the both sides, like Hendrix Blues with chops and fusionary. So I said, okay, I want, would you play, make my demo with me? And David Sanchez, who had made his album, him on keyboards. And then a guy like Will Lee was David's bass player at the time. So then I went into Epic and made Sun is Dancing, maybe Delightful in one of the songs. Maybe Delightful in one of the songs. Three things. And the Epic turned it down. So then walking the streets thinking, how are you going to make it? How are you going to make it? How are you going to make it? And then Barry said, just, you know, stay patient. And I got a phone call from a cat named Raymond Silva from Atlantic. They were doing well with Now Cobham. And he said, you know, maybe we'd be interested in you. So then I gave him my tape that I'd done for the Epic of The Sun is Dancing and maybe with a few things I cut. And I met Jerry Greenberg, who was a president at the time. And then they offered me a deal. But guess what? They said, we want half your publishing. I said, okay. I wanted a deal that bad. I was doing well with Wired. I wrote 4 songs on Wired for Jeff Beck, so I'm making money. Mm-hmm. So then they said, we want half the publishing. I said, no, I don't care. Just sign me. Give me a shot. And they did. And then they said, you have your choice of 2 producers. In-house producers, Arif Mardin or Tommy Dowd. And I said, well, I love them both, but this album is more on the rock side. And I want to use this engineer from London who did the last Mavi Vishnu album called Inner Worlds named Dennis McKay.
Right.
So I thought maybe I should use Tommy Tommy Dowd because he's more on that side of things. And I did. Tommy said, hey, let's work. And Tommy was so cool. And he just let me be me and help me. And I was in that studio, brother, where Aretha and Ray and all that, that's where I cut Garden Love, and that main studio. And it'd be, I want to say another cat was there, is Jimmy Douglas, a young backup cat. He was he was the second. So it'd be him and Dennis McKay and Tommy Dowd and my hot band of Raymond Gomez, David Sanchez, Will Lee on bass, and myself. That was the core. I did a little rehearsal for it so they'd know what to expect in the studio so we could cut it fast because, you know, as you know, studio time and all that's expensive.
Money, yeah.
So we went in there knowing I knew White Knight. Ray and I wrote that and we knew how to do it. I brought in a great arranger named Michael Gibbs who did the Apocalypse album, Mavi Vishnu, because he was brilliant to arrange my strings when I wanted that. And then my friends came, like Carlos Santana came to do the thing called First Love, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
Jeff Beck came to do Satan the Rascal, which is beautiful. So I'm just really honored by that album. And I'm glad that you know about it because some people don't even know about it. But that was my first solo album, my baby.
Yo, yo, what up, everybody? This is Fonte Fontigolo from Team Supreme. We haven't done this in a while, but this conversation was so great and we had so much to cover that we had to make it a two-parter. Look out for part two dropping next week or above this in your podcast feed. In that conversation, Narda talks about his work with Whitney Houston, Aretha Franklin, Starship, and becoming one of the most in-demand producers in all of music of all time. Top flight security of the world, Craig. This conversation was mind-blowing for me, and I know you're going to enjoy it. All right? Y'all tap in. Peace.
What's Love Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo! Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sort. High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again.
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five.
High Five.
Casino.
Casino.
Win at High Five Casino.
.com. High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.